close discussion with her board about some policy that has to be decided in the next 10 minutes. And possibly she can get this possible. So we were going to divide the task. I was going to give an overview of kind of gender voting committee board. And then she was going to talk about the experience of women of color, particularly in the Jackson campaign from all of my feelings about what is needed to build coalitions and the problems of the dual problems of race and sex in trying to get it organized policy. And I will, we really saw this as pretty informal. I was going to talk about kind of three topic headings on three things. One is really the gender gap, what is it, what is the answer? Second is the what is the drawer factor? What do we know and what don't we know? You said before red space, but that was a very important part of what the political scene was this year and what will be in the future. I want to touch on them very briefly, but that does not mean that I don't have a lot to say about it. And most of that might leave something to the question period. And then if Fran is here, we move to what you like to say. And if not, let's open it up and when she comes, we can then shift the agenda. So, let me begin by, that's what Nancy Mendel said, Nancy Mendel, that's what I know. I'm Nancy Klein, I'm a professor at Columbia, I teach for women in politics, and I've been in the city for a
I'm Julie Yeti, and I'm a first year student at Amherst for the
I'm Jean Willis, and I've come to a long series of college effects and practices for 19 years, and I hope to get back in
My name is Jennifer Seals. I'm an administrator at Wellington Community College and a friend of the Women's
I'm Cindy Bradshaw. I'm a teacher at Wellington and I'm a student at Wellington
College. I'm Lexi Levan, and I'm a Barnard Urban Affairs Manager and a worker for the Father's Congress in Los Angeles.
I'm Gail Brewer. I'm the Director of Political Planning for the National Women's Political Caucus in New York. And I work for Councilmember Ruth Messenger, and I used to work for Lieutenant Governor Marion Christensen.
I'm Nancy Silver. I'm a student at UC.
I'm Ken Burrett, and I'm a professor of business management.
I'm Michelle Kapalich, and I'm an editor of Women's Quarterly Review and instructor of English at Oxford University.
Wow, good mix. And something with real political experience and all the future. I think it's a nice comment. Let me begin with what the women's vote was in the moment. After the election results, I got called from a lot of folks who say, wow, didn't do it, did you? And she didn't do it either, did she? And they basically said, so much for the gender gap and so much for the vote. And so I wanted to recruit my position in line and said, look, that if what you expected, the women's vote, and the women's speech monthly, and for all of the votes in Delhi tomorrow, then the gender gap is better. But you understand that the gender gap is much more sophisticated, as women is women voting on the basis of issues and having different priorities. There, you're just not looking at it the right way. And so there are two stories in this past election. One is that Ronald Reagan won by a landslide as a very popular president. But the other story that has been running is that given his popularity, the record on the congressional electoral races is pretty thin. If you think it's important that the Democrats have had gained in 2010, the health and loss of the 14th Congress, and the women's vote is first, because the women's vote really wants to be raised to put down the short. If you look at the poll data, you will find that the four races for liberal sectors running against people identified with the Reagan platform, which won, according to one, at least one, if not two, of the exit polls on the basis of the women's vote. That includes Levin in Michigan, Kerry in Massachusetts, Hawkins in Iowa, and in Illinois. And in all those cases, it's a net gain of two. It's only men who voted. Those would be recent predictions. the Republican Convention. Some of that, that's really not something that women's vote is going out of vote. It's in Illinois, it's a Chicago kind of vote, it's a huge deal. But again, a much larger turnout around the so that there really is something to this gender gap that was not manifested at the national level, even though there was, in fact, a 6-9% gap depending on CBS has now heightened the gap to 6% or an ABC has a 9% gap, and NBC has an 8% gap. There was a gap at the national presidential level, but it really shows itself politically at the local and state level. Moreover, if you look at congressional voting, 47% of men voted for Democratic and women voted for Democratic. Women voted for Democratic. But the women's vote is being co-opted into the Democratic vote. It's not what it is for the nation vote. Right now, the Republicans are not on the side of the issue that they're going to do the that is social services, human rights, and a very different definition of women's rights globally. That when you ask men what's the most important policy, they say that they're economic. When you ask women what's the most important policy, they also say the economy. But for men, the economy is deficit. For women, the economy is unemployment and inflation. That there really is much more to catch the day-to-day experiences of survival. The other major change in the past two kinds of separates men and women is on the issue of social services. Ronald Reagan really has heralded the discussion between the debate now between the New Deal and the Fair Deal. And the Fair Deal is one where government controls stimulate the economy so that those people can get ahead on themselves and have the opportunity to work to get ahead on their own. And he contrasts that to the handout dole-out policy that the New Deal is when people expect independence and information on the stage. When you look at survey data starting in 1972 to 1984, what you find is that men on the Fair Deal should people get ahead on their own, or should the government have some responsibility in helping survive the the men are all way down there, let those people get ahead on their own. Women are in a kind of moderate position. They've moved from being very much in a total service oriented to a middle position, but still helping people help themselves with how to care for them. Now, over time, that has consistently happened. Increased government services, the men are decreased government services. Further decreased, even after 1982, was severe, but after 1982, the women are asking for more services. On defense spending, even in the 84 campaign, men wanted even more money spent on defense spending. Women either wanted to hold the line or decrease it. But what's important to me to emphasize here is that, first of all, we use the word women. Well, definitions are important to different groups of women. And the second point to emphasize is that, this is the success of saying women are the people who welfare state. That is not the case. Everybody in this country is right. Really away from any sense of government providing major services. In part because they feel the government can't do it, that it's inefficient, that it's really, it's not that maybe it shouldn't do it, but it's incapable of doing it. But what women really have held on to is a fundamental view of government having some assured responsibility for the people and maintain some of those entitlements. Which okay. Gives me more time to talk. this is my friend's grandfather, and she will tell you who she is again. But now I'll talk more quickly. Alright, so what's happened is that the basis of the women's vote is that women are given a stimulus voucher called candidates. And as the candidates differentiate themselves on issues of social service delivery, on issues of women's rights, on civil rights, on defense spending, women are finding them closer to candidates that take the more New Deal side, and men are finding themselves closer to candidates that take the more Fair Deal side. And they're voting according to them. But different groups of women, unlike what people traditionally thought about the black vote, the Jewish vote, the labor vote, or as it used to be, women are not making decisions of the group because organizations are informing the women. It is private decisions that collectively and that's an important distinction. What it means is there's not the same kind of consciousness of what is important to women And therefore, it's also different groups of women with different emblems, so that minority women have started with more emphasis on social service than middle class. Middle class women are putting more emphasis on abortion, women's rights, peace, and environment. Younger women are making judgments that are different, on different issues than our older women. But that's both the strength and the weakness of the endogam. The weakness is that it's very hard to organize in a cohesive way. Its strength is a part of the use, because you can't just come out and say, this is what I'm for, and bring all women over. That is a very, very agenda. The next thing we're going to talk about is Geraldine Ferraro. Like myself, many times, I put that in pictures, but I do. I thought she'd make a much bigger difference. I really thought that she needed the women's vote, that what the women's vote is fundamentally about is saying that women are taken seriously. But here is a candidate now that is making the field want to take it seriously. Unfortunately, it was a risk of board strategy, the approach of board strategy, the approach of nominating her, and then board the discussion of the position. And so I never in my life thought we'd have a woman running for vice president who didn't set the agenda. You know, a bottom line issue that I think all women are concerned about, but there's a sense of reason that didn't set the agenda. I never thought that a woman who has voted against the MX and who's been active before the field would talk about her ability to trust the body. That the message was definitely not an appeal to the women's vote, and I think the mistake the Democrats made not only with women but with other groups was they thought by getting their endorsement from a so-called organized segment of the population, they would then be able to go after the white male who fall the most important voters. And therefore planned a strategy after the nomination clearly aimed at trying to get the ethnic white male vote. And that was in part then to address the women factor then, not to deal with all these other side issues that were concerned about social justice. So the Ferraro campaign, while I think it's terrific that she ran, and I'm a big partisan of her, I'd say they made several mistakes. One is that she didn't run the women's voices. That is, talk about the issues from women's perspective, not necessarily say, this is what women want, but to say, when I speak about this issue, this is the perspective that I bring, and that's what makes me unique. If she tries to compare her veto to Bush's veto, most people lose. Bush has a very interesting veto, you don't stand up in terms to talk about the unique thing you bring to a situation that's been missing in all these years. The second is that the women's movement, through the activities of the National Organization for Women, became seen as basically a radical woman in the Democratic Party. And that a major mistake was to incorporate into the party rather than to do what they did in 1982, which the caucus has done, which is to be an independent campaign force. So even though they endorse, they campaign independent of the Democratic Party, and they criticize candidates when they don't talk about their issues and try to put pressure on them. The women's movement, because it's so clearly identified with now these days, got assumed and didn't have an independent voice talking about why are we supporting this candidate in the first place, not because we're Democrats, but because there's budget cuts that go after the hurt eventually. There are issues of reproductive freedom, there are issues of civil rights that are being hacked away by the current administration that means something to us and to the disadvantaged group. The final thing I want to talk about is voter registration. That, in my sense, community organizing in the 60s and 70s is now voter registration is the aim of the major. That what happened here is in age to actually other groups discovered what the Black Union started in 1976, that there was a major need for local organizing around local issues, and that the big push was now start raising money that at the local level groups would gain more control and become empowered through the process of voter registration. I didn't think Republicans had that many people to register, but it turns out that there were a lot of people to be registered, not all of them. And so that the Republicans spent $7 a head, registered almost as many people as the progressive group. The voter registration drive was conducted by the PACs and the Republican Party. On the other side, whatever that side is, was done by voluntary organizations. The Democratic Party did almost no voter registration. It spent its money to voter registration after most of the deadlines were closed. And it gave marginal returns on GOP to get out. I think that needs to be understood as a rule of thumb. Well, the national party wanted to expand the local organization, not the because they knew how to win with the constituency that they had. And if they were to expand it any further, then they got new constituents, new potential competitors. And that that would then mean that whatever happened at the national level, they could potentially lose control at the local level. So that the question of voter registration is a much more political question than simply the good citizenship. And that's what the Democratic Party is failing on this issue, even though it appears to have that to do it. The good news is that after all this talk about the fact that it was a major failure, and I think it's important to understand that a set of voluntary organizations is way underfunded, not spending $7 per head like the Republican Party's last tax, registered the same number of people. I mean, that's pretty impressive. But in addition to that, the initial reports were that women in black didn't turn out, and the Census Bureau reports show a major increase in turnout among minorities and the unemployed. And so that all that effort paid off. The problem is, do you link that payoff to the election for the people of a particular candidate? I think people at local levels are finding that this increased participation is going to potentially change the local agenda. How much? I don't know. That's a real question. But the other thing that it's shown is that community organizing is not the dead issue that people first thought it was right after the election. And that the experts aren't particularly all that smart because they all have the answer to it doesn't really matter. I think it's phenomenal that you had an upturn voter registration at a time where the key thing we know in 4 to 5 about registration increases in interesting campaigns. You know, you read a novel, it's interesting to finish it. If it gets boring, you know what the end's going to be, you put it down. This campaign was boring. You knew the outcome of this campaign by July. In fact, in July, the big news story was the ratings in all 50 states, 48 states, 49 states. And so that to have people who are fundamentally non-empowered, still become active and mobilized and engage in voter activity is not exactly seen as the most direct way to gain power on the floor. Even if it's such a boring election, it really is fine for the vitality of the people. Any of yourself is total of being up. Anyone
else do yourself? No, I'm very practical. I thought it was quite interesting. I have never been a suburbanite before. And now I'm doing a New York show, part of Christ, moving back to New York. And I discovered that New York is a series of other countries, but I'm 2 of 7 of them. I got lost and crossed Bronx. When I ended up in the Bronx, I discovered that I really don't know New York at all. And as I wheeled around on my way and came up on FDR Drive on 116th Street, I discovered yet another country. So then I got to these pastoral towns here in the third. And there is some allegorical symbolism here that people are working for my remarks. But I was at some people. Now, Ethel and I met when I was a GOK at the Institute of Policy. And that was more apt than I even knew when I first said I would come because I had been at Harvard during the dream of activism some years ago as a student and as a law student, so I'm also apt to it. But my most recent incarnation with New York was in Washington, in both what I call formal and informal, but with a formally, I was the executive director of the Congressional Black Caucus. I also worked very closely as Ellen Gordon's executive assistant at New York City, and then as the first director of the office that Jimmy Carter created to coordinate all the federal people in front of opportunity policy. And that was at a time when Jim Carter was supporting. I also was Ed Brooks, legislative assistant at the Commercial Washington job. After all of that, I decided to come to New York and to international council when I was waiting for the president of Operation Prosper Capital. And in that capacity, I'm trying to be interested in the international domestic politics. But having said that, part of the informal political work that, that I was doing in Washington, I guess, gives me the context for the
blacks in particular were extraordinarily disadvantaged by long wave power. There began to be long before I considered us to be secret, which is one of the things that that was described, because we early recognized the seriousness of the threat and began to organize in the black community around issues. And I think that one of the most startling observations that I had, and I think one of the things that explains Ethel's comments about why voter registration would go up in the midst of the most self-defined campaigns, demand, is that people in the community, people at the local level, are concerned and are motivated by issues. It isn't just tourism, it isn't just the question of who the candidates are. It is what they stand for, and it is what they will do about the issues which are most vexing to the community. So, the first thing I wanted to say is that issues were extremely important, and one of the things that happened in my community was that the leadership got together quite early, and this is a document that I had written for them with several others, and created a people's platform. And of course, the Democrats didn't do very much with this document, although several people commented afterwards that they wished they had. But the point of the matter was that they got together and not only formulated their position on the issues, but proposed specific solutions. And worked very hard to build a coalition around issues. And I think if you look at the Jackson contract in that context, whatever was good or bad about it, it was really an issue-based candidacy. And I think that that's what gave it to China. And as you look at the local configuration, what you found was that people actually transformed the basic core issues at the local level. Some of them move over to their particular situation, thereby laying the groundwork for the future and for future coalitions in some panel. So issues really are important. Let me say a couple of words about, I guess, what I'm supposed to be talking about, and that is the whole question of gender politics as they play out in the black community. And it's difficult in a sense analytically to talk about the situation in the black continent, because there is a commonality of suffering in the black community that is not gender specific. And that is very different from what is happening in the black community. That it is true that white women, and indeed all women, have disadvantages. But those disadvantages are particularly stark for black women, and also for black men. And therefore, to talk about gender politics context is somewhat misleading, because the realities are that while black family structure is increasingly feminized, and when one talks about feminization of fabric, let me tell you, they are talking about black and other women of color, because we are a disproportionate part of that component that is pushing the statistics toward the concept of feminization. And it is in that guise that black women have unique disadvantages among the disadvantages. Having said that, an additional factor is what is happening to black men. Because since 1960, black men have lost 13 percentage points in absolute labor participation. And the dissolution of the black family is, in some respects, a direct consequence of this particular phenomenon. In good times and in bad, you know, Reagan has made big production out of economic recovery, and I feel kind of, whose economy is looking at that. Because in good times and in bad, black unemployment has always been about 2.5 times black unemployment. In this climate, it is over 3 times in many, many areas, and nationally at 2.75 times. And in 1983, one out of every 3 blacks in this country was below the poverty line, which, as you understand, is the most needed definition. 48% of all black men were unemployed. situation. So it is very hard in some respects for black women to think of ethnic Christian men, because they look away and they see their sons and indeed their husbands or ex-husbands as a piece of cat facing complex tensions. The second thing to say is that where the administration has charted a policy initiative, I think it is fair to say that those initiatives have had a pointedly negative effect on black and Hispanic women. Pointedly negative. In other words, if one, for example, talks about welfare reform and the welfare system, and you look at the percentage of black families in poverty, then you can see the impact of that policy. But it's not just that. If one talks about affirmative action, and one looks at the marginality of those black women who are poor, the negatives not only affect women who are in the workforce, and there's no question about that. I don't want to make it sound as if I'm trying to make the separation between and among women in terms of disadvantage. But it becomes even more difficult if you're trying to get into the workforce. So that is another set of issues. We were talking about the difference between maintaining some position and getting participate in the workforce. That is one. The interesting thing about all of this, from my perspective, is that black women consistently respond to the call for political involvement in much larger numbers than their counterparts in other communities. And in fact, in the 82 off-year elections, black women who were registered to vote had the highest turnout among all groups of voters. Therefore, they become a very potent and active part of the electorate. And issue recognition is often the key to this participation. And that's an observation that is sometimes lost on our progressive strategy. Because as to the extent that they don't talk about women's issues, you can imagine how little they talk about what I would really call, in some sense, black women's issues because of the imperatives of their lives. That is a discouraging phenomenon. And I have to tell you that black women are increasingly quite angry about the absolute abrogation of issues that are extreme pertinent to them. Having said that, I think that it's fair to move into a more provocative formulation of the issue. That in the most lancing of effects and in the most facile of truth. Addition, since life ought to be art once in a while, it would be very nice to see black women involved in real and genuine leadership in the so-called women's movement. And the reality is that that is rare. Now, I don't know you all, I've always been told that one of the reasons why we want affirmative action is because there are certain sensitivities that come up in politics today. That is also true in political activism. Part of the reason why the agenda is sometimes skewed is because the right people are not seen. Part of the reason why the outreach efforts that are made are so futile is because the right people are not in the outreach. And it occurs to me that the women's movement will consistently have problems with legitimacy unless and until it stops reflecting in its actions and in its advocacy the same problems that it criticizes in society at large. In other words, no black woman worth her salt is going to spend a lot of time when the racism that they are supposed to be concerned about that they face every day is reflected in the organization revolve around the issues having to do with the area. And that is the reality. Now, one of the things that I believe is critical is a coalition which proceeds from the premise that Black women, Hispanic women, have certain experiences and skills that could actually strengthen the thrust of women's movement. This sort of came back that I was very intrigued by the fight for the UA, because one of the pivotal states was, excuse me, my home state of North Carolina, which I have said was the worst congressional election. From the state that Dr. Jesse Hammond and John Eastman signed to canonize. And by the way, 13% of all blacks in North Carolina are not religious. What the analysts say. And those who did.
I don't believe
that. That's right. Those who did face substantial economic deprivation if they did not. But that's another conversation. Having said that, one of the interesting things about North Carolina is that some of the stuff is so bad here that blacks have, for a very long time, been extraordinarily organized. They have a statewide Democratic coalition that meets, that pushes, that organizes, that works together. And they have some substantial influence in the legislature. And they have representation of within the legislature. Therefore, it seems to me that strategically, the women's movement would have been well advised to put a great deal of effort and emphasis on involving the capable black women who have emerged in leadership roles in the North Carolina Black Democratic Coalition, as well as to bring national black women together in this climate where there is a substantially organized black political presence that could carry some water for the women's movement. Now, that is not to say that it would have passed, but it would have been an interesting experiment. And the same is true for Illinois, even more true. And it's crazy what they did. They did it.
No, I was about to say something stronger than crazy.
Suicidal. But I'm just simply saying that you understand. See, we want as black women, I think, I want as a black woman, I'm not going to be where I choose it. I want as a black woman to be able to have, to be integrated with it. I want to be able to spend time on women's issues and black issues and not see the contradictions. Unfortunately, that kind of integrated approach is not possible. So if I have to choose where I place, then I am going to choose that struggle, which not only affects me as a woman, but also affects my children, my nephews, my sons. And it shouldn't be that. It shouldn't be that way. But unfortunately, that's what it is. Now, the last thing I want to say is that, you know, even while I make this comment, there are problems within the black community that are sometimes fueled by the conflict that all women face whenever they want to be involved in political endeavor. Our community in that respect is not unlike any other community. And it therefore would help black women if they could have an alliance and a coalition with women all over. Because then they too would have a constituency in the difficult dealings that happen. That too is a very difficult proposition to sell in light of the configuration and behavior of many of the main groups and their leadership. What I see for the future is, I agree with them, the name of the game, both positively and negatively, is local organizing and local political structures. That appears to me to be the way of the future. That is positive in that I think that a lot of new voices and new solutions and innovation and new leadership, both male and female, will emerge that is negative because of the kind of thing that Ethel described, the part of this court of law, where local activism may change the elites, may reconfigure, and that is therefore a challenge to young people. Right? So it's a harder struggle in many respects. The second thing is that I think that there's going to have to be a candid and frank reassessment of what it means to have coalition politics. Coalition politics is becoming as much of a dirty word in some quarters as integration has been. Coalition politics does not mean subsuming oneself into the already articulated agenda. It means formulating a new agenda that reflects the important components of what previously existed. It may mean unselfish advocacy. And I think that, you know, I haven't told somebody, I just left a meeting of several black leaders, and I said, I was going to send them all samples, and I don't believe it. But I was going to say, self-indulgence is a vice. I said, and I was going to make a pillow trip to each other, and then to have something to, you know, to sit on. But that is true across the board, that self-indulgence is a vice, and that part of coalition politics is sometimes recognizing the fact that your particular agenda, your particular approach, your particular analysis, may have to take a back seat from time to time in the industry of great good. And that's not self-indulgence, that's maturity. We have some maturation to do in the coalition era. Third, I do want to put in a plug for the role of issues in stimulating political involvement, because I do think that we get to the point of looking at politics like so much of a big giant chess game, and all you gotta do is manipulate pieces and everything will come out. It's not true, and people are much more intelligent than I think illusions sometimes give credit for. And therefore there is a rigor about political endeavor that requires us to really analyze the issues and really educate them. So that's my next work. Last but not least, I don't think that any of the old canards about what is progressive or what is conservative is that these are extraordinary times. And I think that part of the problem is that we have to be afraid to re-examine the premises of which we have to be willing. You have to be willing to confess that certain things that we can hold to bring back certain things to mind, and that we have to assess. And it may mean, for example, that some of the things that are being used in the most odious of all possible fashions are nonetheless legitimate issues. Just all this craziness. I'm trying to figure out how to say it, but all this crazy right-wing religiosity and family values, you know, all these, they're using the most fast-evolving kinds of dogmas, and yet, even as aggressive, we get up now that family structures are appealing, and what's happening today really influences what's happening in many ways. So we need to wrest control of certain critical issues from those who are resistant to dogmas, and not reject it out of hand as an issue simply because of the way it's been distributed. I think I probably said more than it was apparently accurate. That's because I was touring these other countries. But I hope that at least, without knowing what Ethel had said before I dashed up the stairs, we talked that she had said was much more rigorous. But at any rate, I hope there's some proof for discussion, and I think it's much more fun to have.
Well, I want to open it up in your, because you opened the provocative door, I want to open it up to a provocative discussion.
Okay.
And that is the two somewhat related points. One is, I think you're right, that the key, because if there's going to become more, it's going to be at the local level, it's going to be around issues, it's not going to become more minor, it's going to become more minor,
But that's not, that's a long one coming, it's coming at all, but that if there are common goals, which there will have to be more and more, at the local level, I think there's going to be more room to play. Because people understand what's at stake, what you do. And now, if you're a person, I know you're a person saying that as your movement looks towards some concern about being integrated, not only racialized, but class, sexual orientation, and age. And it's a movement that I think is doing a lot in that direction. But again, it's what you talk about is the women's movement. The women's movement has a national face, which is much more organization. And then it has a kind of live little topic all over the country in the global community. And I think they're very different. I think that the domestic violence shelters are different kinds of places than headquarters for the caucus or now. I think that abortion clinics and health centers look different than some other professional women's groups do. I think 9 to 5 look different than Clue. I think there are different topics out there, and that the women who are concerned about women in literature look a little different than women who are concerned about women in justice. That in a sense we are everywhere and we are everyone. What my concern from what you're saying is that it's going to get worse. Because in the Reagan movement, the rhetoric of the national women's and national media star is to get locked in. You know, we are in trouble because we're losing the young people. So we've been apologizing for being middle class movies for the last 15 years, and apologizing for lost our base because we are middle class movies. And that the women's movement, in the national sense of what the women's movement is, not in what I think everyone is struggling with, in some sense, everyone has my women's movement. My women's movement is racist, it's sexist, classist, whatever. But that the national front is going to become much more back to the basics. Moving membership rapidly is a very media-oriented view, and they will hear concerns about how it's represented in this context.
Are you talking about that?
No, I'm talking about it now. I'm talking about what one thinks about. That could include this magazine, that could include topics, that could include NARAP, that could include media. We can talk about what are the national faces. Now, many of these organizations have local groups that look very different from what the national mood is, but who are the spokesperson for the women's movement who are identified? They're going to go much less in the direction of integration.
Let me just give a practical example. Sometimes real-world examples. And it actually has something to do with gender. We're all doing it now that I think of it. About 3 years ago, I was asked to be a speaker at a national Democratic Women's Day. And I was talking about economic issues and the sense of like women of color in terms of the economy. And we had a fairly contentious discussion because I said to them, you were well about Zippers Canada. And they all said, in the end, after some blood, that actually I was probably right. They were going to do something bad. But one of the things that happened in this discussion was I raised the economic equity act. And I raised it as a perfect example of what's wrong with women's movement. And Geraldine Thoreau was in the room and she almost had a heart attack. So then she, you know, they of course deferred to her and she was very strong. And her statements about why it was such a perfect thing, and I said, yeah, it was a great thing as far as it went. And somebody had asked me to go do a little side interview, so I was walking up to me and she was going on a pension weekend. And I spun on my heel, it just came from somewhere, and I said, see, but that's precisely what's wrong. I said, you know, I'm all for portability of pensions. I said, but what if you ain't got no pension before? I said, you see that? I said, where is the provision in this bill for those women who have no pension protection at all? And what are you prepared to advocate as a national approach for them, just like you advocate a national approach for portability? I said, see now, if I had been in the room as you discussed the formulation of this legislation, I said, and I don't mean I, a plant farmer, but I as a black person, we would have talked about what kind of provision needed to be examined and what kind needed to be pushed forward. Well, jaws dropped, because all of a sudden it hit them squarely between them. And then in fact, this was a true statement, and it was true about several other elements of this omnibus piece of legislation. Now, on the media, as you recall, we were almost coerced, blackmailed, beat up on if we didn't lockstep in favor of the Economic Equity Act, and I really thought it was a good piece of legislation, but not that good. And it raised fundamental issues about what it is that we advocate, who it is that sets the agenda, and why it is, therefore, that the agenda that's set is deficient.
See, it raises this issue of experience, but it's analogous to what women say, although many women legislate for reasons that they do this, but when a job still goes through, and the job is reported building finalism, we start screaming that these are men's jobs. So that when a job still is then redefined, we then say, well, who are women's jobs? Well, the women's jobs tend to be built in, tend to be, you know, certain kinds of target jobs, and they exclude certain kinds of women. And so the next step is, what does one say about the dispersion of variety? And variety of jobs that are taken out. And where does that sensitivity to those issues come in? It comes from experience. And I think that's kind of the key problem on the national front, that while there is a lot of rhetoric, and I think sincere concern about immigration, there is no meaningful discussion of shared experience. And then, yes, Alice Walker can go to cocktail parties. I love Alice Walker. She goes to many cocktail parties. But she does, all right? But it's not the same thing as talking about, you know, day-to-day how people are living their lives. And yes, the families that are in poverty, and many of them put on the agenda, but it went on the policy agenda when middle-class women were getting divorced, and all of a sudden, because the nature of no-fault divorce, they were losing all their basic property rights and now becoming poor. The practice of feminization of poverty is there for a long time. It becomes a kind of public policy issue when it happens to middle-class white women. So that there is a dynamic there that has to do with who has power and how do people vote for power. And the last thing I was going to say, it wasn't a government before, but rather than say it's fact, I would say it's a position. And what happened in North Carolina and in Illinois on the issue of the ERA was in part the following effect, which is the blacks will view it the same way, and that if they're not, we can't afford the court. Because the worst thing that we could do is show we're on their side, because that's one of the reasons they don't want us, and they don't want to give us the ERA because they think we're liberal commies, homosexuals. And therefore, if we go court the black community on this, we will lose. And this is what is perceived as plain politics. In other words, it's a trade-off. And there's no maybe recognition that that's short-term politics, but long-term politics. Now, I'm not saying that happens, but that is a believable scenario. I will also say that on the other side, there are women and women's movement who feel two things. One is that, and that's why I think we should be productive. One is that women are always being asked, that when you talk about coalition building and you say, well, for the greater good, women are always being told they should become next. And that there is, for a lot of these women who have been active in other movements and now in their own movement, don't want to hear it as much. And the second thing they feel is that black legislators, black male legislators, are not sensitive or sympathetic to them, and trademark that this is a key power play thing, and are not on their side. And in some places it's true. On the other hand, the Congressional Black Caucus supported women's rights issues across the board every single time. So that
we can't do this.
You know, I guess why, Trey and I think that when we talk about culture, I take away from you that it's going to be issue-oriented, it's going to be at the local level, and then it's going to take a lot of time.
Yeah, that's fine.
It's only a point.
But you know, just one more observation about what you said in terms of our issues will come next. I guess what I would love to see is courage and creativity to recast the solutions that are close to our issues, to defining what our issues are. I think that that's what most thoughtful black women are saying. You know, there was a movie, very moving
statement given by someone truth many years ago, the refrain of it, well, they're not a woman. And I mean, so if you are going to talk about women, that is your point, then they are a woman. And I think that that's the kind of, because see, if we could feel at home in the women's movement, then it would be our assignment to sensitize those black girls. So then that becomes our role to black women, to get them online. But as long as there's a sense of discomfort, then we can't, in good conscience, discharge that responsibility, because then let's say for us, then you'll be really seeing our issues being woven into. And I will admit to you that in several test cases, the answer is no. You know, maybe I'm wrong.
I would take a different one. I was going to survey data, which is not included in exponential stuff. But in fact, black women have the most packaged progressive position. That is, if you look at people, not only they don't take the most progressive position, Hispanic women, not as much as black women, have one white women as a group. And then different packets of white women. That's also important. Mm-hmm. But that both truth and the truth that black women take the most progressive line on issues across the board and package them together in a more consistent way. Is that there's some understanding of the issue of feminism that's political. And that if there's some understanding of the role of the state that's a little more political than insurance proposing. An understanding of how one interacts with the community, even just the duality of birth.
That's certainly true.
But I guess, and this comes back to, you know, kind of what would be the feminist response to this, and I think that that's right, but that part of the problem with feminist organizing is just the heterogeneity of the situation. So, okay, let me talk about that, and then I'll stop and we'll open it up, okay? Well, we could work that out. Now I'm speaking on my feet. And that is, look, I always said to you, you know, if you ask men about the economy, you ask women about the economy, from men you get deficits of the word and you get inflation on the phone. Well, if you then ask women about the economy again in some different kind of way, from all the women who are professional, you'll get professional mobility. From white middle class yuppie women, you'll get younger women, actually, yuppie, including myself, concerned about mobility, tenure, partnership, and all those kinds of craft issues. Then my students are concerned about getting those jobs to begin with, you know, opportunity and advancement. When you talk to high school students, their notion of opportunity is to get a job that's not going to be pushing blues or working at McDonald's, because that's the most expanded sector. In society, so that language of what you mean by economic opportunity, and if I were to think about an issue, however, that would go across economic concerns for the group of state here, that each one of those women is at some level, whether you know, it's number one, number two, number seven, state here is an issue. Maybe there is a way in which one can start someplace, but when you talk about daycare, don't only talk about group of families. But don't only talk about professional standards, but really talk about it as a legitimate concern for all different kinds of women. There's different kinds of daycare policies. You then talk about daycare policies, you think about putting in public schools, have to contribute to how it's going to reinforce policies that already exist in perpetuating that public school. But I'm really, what I'm asking for, kind of laying it out, is women are having. And some of them care about minorities, black people, and others as racist as possible, we include them, you know. And if you raise these issues, you lose them. And other women would like to be sensitive, and they think in their heart of hearts they're very concerned, but they don't want to be over concerned about that one special interest after all. They care about everything else, like the woman we talked to at Harvard. And then there are other women who think they are concerned and have no clue what this really is. So how do you organize
this? I'm just going to say that as an example of what you're talking about, I went to the Incredible Children's Defense Fund conference a couple of weeks ago with a very bright LGBT fact that the topic was adolescent pregnancy. And the notion at the end after speaker was we need to go back to the real family values. We need to go back to teaching children discipline. That's exactly what speaker after speaker said. So that's picking up on what you're saying of being not afraid to use different terms to talk about what's happening now. And I'm sure she'll be very successful with the campaigns on child care and prenatal dollars and so on and so forth. But it was interesting. That's exactly what you said, transpiring as a politician. I think it'll work. The second thing I just thought I would mention, which is really scary, and it's an example of Reagan and his force, but NARAL locally was apparently moving from one office in New York to another. Landlord increased the rent they moved. There was subletting in that space, and the new owner, the prime tenant stated to the owner of the building they're moving in. And the owner of the building said, oh no, they're not, my building will be bombed and they cannot sublet because they're moving out of space. Second thing happened was they called up a local group that for years has provided through Title V a senior citizen, you know, somebody to do clerical work in the office. And this time when they called up the senior citizen organization said, just a minute, we'll call you back. They called back the next day and said, sorry, we're federally funded, we can't give you a senior this year as we have for 10 years. So in other words, Reagan just not pulling the plug, obviously, but covertly on some of these programs. I thought that was a very scary contradiction to the uproars about the Children's Defense Fund.
I would take that line of the Children's Defense Fund. I agree that we have to appropriate the line of that. But when I hear someone say something like stricter family, better family values, you know, Moynihan believes in poor people, black people have that problem with that their men go off and they, you know, they're left there with poor women struggling to raise their kids. And that implies a lot of things that I'm very uncomfortable.
I agree.
There's a difference in saying that we're concerned about family.
Okay.
And I think that's where the women's movement and other groups are quickly running to the right to reappropriate language without listening to the rhetoric.
Well, to fill it, you know, you said something about heterogeneity. In your constituency, so also the women are heterogeneous. And I'm saying that the coach is probably right. And, you know, as I'm racing, usually I can find a way home. It's like racing down to the 7:40 or the 8:19 train and racing across the track. But, you know, I've got a kid with a condition of education. She's calling me and saying, well, which Stoker's to lay? You know, when will I see you? I mean, these are all scary things. And the whole question of family is very interesting because, see, when I talk about family, I mean, you know, I have a family. It is not the traditional, you know, male-female 2.5 kids, two chickens and every cat and five cars and garage, but it's a family. So the point is that you can talk about family and family values without you can take the language without buying into 2.5 kids, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Second thing is that, you know, I've been in a real back and forth with this new organization and trying to come to terms with. One of the things that I've been struggling with is the notion that public interest, in the public interest, has become synonymous with sloppiness. You know, I mean, we want to be touchy-feely, nice and manly, so we don't want to be rigorous. And that's true about the difficulty of grappling with these things. And it's also true about family values. And it is not a bad word to say we have to be disciplined. The question is discipline toward what end? If it's discipline toward relieving suffering, if it's discipline toward achieving greater egalitarianism and fairness, if it's discipline toward enhancing communications and understanding of all people and reducing the risk of war, then that is